Honorable Chief Justice Stephen R. Jensen presiding is now in session.
You may be seated.
Thank you.
Good morning. I want to welcome all of you that are here this morning. We appreciate the public coming to attend the court sessions that we have. We generally hold our court sessions in Pierre in our courtroom in the Capitol. Twice a year, we try to travel, and the South Dakota School of Mines was one of our travel locations for this year. And before we start, I want to particularly express my appreciation on behalf of the court to the South Dakota School of Mines, President Rankin, for all of their work in helping to get this set up and provide a great location for us to hold our arguments this week. I particularly want to thank Jade Herman, who has been our point of contact at the School of Mines and has been extremely helpful in terms of getting us set up. With that, we do have one high school here today, the Moorcraft High School from Moorcraft, Wyoming. And so we want to welcome all of you. Thanks for coming this morning. And we have three cases set for argument this morning. The first case is Nationwide Agribusiness Insurance Company versus Burgess, Fitch, and Hunter Peterson. On behalf of the defendant appellant, Hunter Peterson, Mike McGill appears and will be arguing. And on behalf of Nationwide Agribusiness Company, plaintiff and appellee, we have Tara Fisher Larson, who is present and will be arguing on behalf of appellee. Each side will have an opportunity to present arguments for 20 minutes, and then appellant will have a 10-minute rebuttal argument after that. So with that, Mr. McGill, you may proceed with your argument.
May it please the court and counsel. My name is Michael J. McGill. I'm an attorney. I live in Beersford, South Dakota. I represent Hunter Peterson in this appeal to the court out of a judgment from the Sixth Circuit at Haakon County. This action was originally started as a negligence action based upon premises liability and general negligence. This is an insurance contract. Although I didn't file the response to the appellant's to the reply in this case, I was blinded a little bit by a very strong precedent that I've got to deal with, and it's Corzon. It's the Corzon case, which I'm sure you all are familiar with, but precedent sometimes can become a blinder. And as I reread that case, as I prepared this oral argument, I realize that there is a serious issue in this case, and it deals with the issue we brought before the court, in which the circuit court ruled against us, and that is whether concurrent causes can be the legal cause for a harmful result. What happened in this case is that there was a family ranch that has several RVs. As I traveled across South Dakota to attend the hearing today, I saw several RVs being used all over the place. Every one of them wasn't recreational. It was for a farming purpose. We have an insurance contract involved in this case, and it's not a workers' comp insurance policy. And it's not an RV policy. The RV coverage that exists in this case comes into existence and disappears off and on as you read through the policy. But in the final analysis, there's no RV coverage. So what we have in this case is the story of a family ranch. We have Truett Fitch asks his son or his nephew, who's a 17-year-old boy. He's a senior in high school at Phillip High School, much like these high schoolers here. How many of them will operate a gator? But I would recommend every rancher to go home and read their policy to see if it has an RV exclusion, because the policy in this particular case said that the RV is not covered if it's used in a farming purpose. Okay.
And do you acknowledge that, Mr. McGill? Do you acknowledge? It seems as though you're brief seems to accept and to acknowledge that that's the case in this policy.
Well, I think that a fair reading of the contract would lead anyone to the conclusion that the when the RB is used for a farming purpose, it is excluded from coverage.
But yes. So the answer is yes, you acknowledge
that? Yes, I acknowledge that, yes. But that's the starting point on this. What we're saying is that there were concurrent causes
that I understand that argument as well, of course.
Okay. So the cause of action in the trial court started off as a negligence action based upon these concurrent things that occurred. That when Truett asked Hunter to come out and spray the weeds, this is a pasture that's 30 miles north of Phillip in Hocken County, South Dakota, which is expansive land. Truett brought Hunter out there, showed him the gator, showed him this sprayer that he's going to use, and then he leaves him. In fact, Truett has to show him what a Canadian thistle is. Hunter had never sprayed Canadian thistles. He had never used the gator to spray thistles. He was left with no communication device. He was left on this pasture and this ranch, 30 miles literally from Phillip, to do this job. Truett, his uncle, left. At the time that Truett was asked Hunter to come out to do the work, there was no conversation regarding terms of compensation. There's no express employment contract in this case. And there was no hours of work. He had come out to the farm as a neighborly type of assistance and worked for his grandpa at times, but it was like a grandpa's helper. And what we have is Hunter goes out on this rugged terrain, on this pasture, where there's drains draining into the creek bed, and he is using this gator to spray the weeds. In his left hand, he has the wand, a short wand, and on his right hand, he's operating this gator. And he hits a rivulet that drains into the creek bed. Boom, it flips over the gator, and he's trapped under the gator. He doesn't have a cell phone. There's no cell service out there. He doesn't have a two-way radio. Truett didn't provide it to him. We filed a lawsuit based upon premises liability and general negligence. Now, in this insurance policy, it's a contract, and it's your duty to set the rules that exist for contract law across the great state of South Dakota. It's a sacred duty. I understand that. This contract says that we will not provide any insurance for an employee because it's not a workers' compensation policy. It's a general farm liability policy in coverage H. And we're saying that coverage exists under this policy, under coverage H, irrespective of the fact that the a motor vehicle or the gator, a recreational vehicle, was utilized in the accident. This contract, we have to say it's not ambiguous in that regard. It simply does not cover employees. It simply does not cover the gator. So in the trial court below, what Judge Northrup ruled is that there is a genuine issue, a disputed material fact, as to whether or not he was an employee. And we're saying that that is the correct ruling. That is correct. There should be a trial in this case to determine whether or not he was an employee. There was no express written agreement as to employment. The insurance company argues that there was an implied agreement. Now, the court has to look at all the facts and circumstances to determine whether or not there is an actual implied contract. That's what the law in South Dakota is. The cases that exist out there, Setlip versus Atkins, the Bergeson case that was cited by Judge Northrup, basically say that if there isn't an express contract, there could be an implied contract that could be created by the facts and circumstances of the case. And we're saying that it was correct for Judge Northrup to say that is to be tried. That's for a fact finder.
What facts exist in this case that are disputed on the issue of whether Hunter was an employee?
Well, he had gone out to the farm at certain times to haul bales. He had gone out there and worked with his grandpa on occasion over the years. Now he's a 17-year-old guy. He's called on August 13th to come out, but there was no conversation with respect to compensation or duties. He was just told to spray these weeds.
It wouldn't have to be under the agreement of definition, the definition of employee, just as that term is defined. That also contemplates, seems to be a broad definition of employee that would include an arrangement that's not only implied, but could be compensated or uncompensated. So there may be some difference of opinion on what he was compensated, although it looks like he was compensated to some extent, but maybe not according to a specific salary. But what facts are, when lined up with, let's just say, the definition of employee at this point, what facts, when applied to that legal standard, would generate disputed issues of material fact for a trial?
Well, in this case, there was no express agreement, and there was no oral agreement as to compensation. And the Supreme Court opinions in this regard, Setlip discusses the case. It's Mann versus Mann.
It wouldn't have to be, Mr. McGill, right? If you apply the definition of employee, it could be uncompensated. The definition contemplates it could be uncompensated.
Well, under our case law in South Dakota, and it's cited in the Setlip opinion, and it's the Mahan versus Mahan case, and it's a family, and that's why I want to emphasize this is a family ranch situation. And in Mahan versus Mahan, what we have is someone cares for their brother-in-law for several years, and then he dies, but there's a promise made, allegedly, that he would pay for her out of his estate. And of course, she doesn't get paid, so she sues to bring on an implied contract. Our Supreme Court ruled in that case that when there's a family relationship, the showing that there is a implied contract or an understanding they'd be paid has to be proved by clear and convincing evidence, and there must be an expectation to pay and expectation to be paid. We're saying in this case, the facts are that he had gone out there. He never had a conversation with the parents, Mr. and Mrs. Fitch, that he would be paid that day, that he was going out to work that day. What happened is there's a W-2 that was sent out in the following January for $3,200. And a check was put into his checking account in November or December of the year of the accident that Hunter didn't even know about. And it's for like an hour of work, $3,200. There are questions of fact that need to be resolved in terms of what the understanding of the parties was and so on.
Counsel, are you asking the court not to apply the definition of employee in the insurance contract?
Well, we're saying that there's a genuine issue of material fact before the court as to whether or not there was an implied contract, whether an implied contract exists for employment. And the trial court ruled in our favor in that regard, and we're saying that that wasn't error, that was correct. But we're really, I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, you were referring to case law dealing with these family situations, but here we have an insurance contract with a specific definition for employee. Are we not required then to apply that definition in determining whether there is insurance coverage?
Well, I think you have to apply the definition, certainly, yes. Now, as to the other issue, what the trial court also ruled is that the legal cause of this accident was the RV. And we are trying to bring to the court the notion that the court should consider adopting the concurrent cause doctrine, which essentially says that there are alternative causation factors involved in causing an automobile accident, or in this case, use of a gator, that necessarily shouldn't foreclose coverage. In other words, the RV exclusion should not be applied in this case, and that the trial court engaged in fact-finding by discounting the non-motor vehicle-related causes of this accident.
Could this accident have occurred without the use of the gator?
Well, I think we have to examine the definition of legal cause in that regard. And when you look at legal cause, you look at what caused a harmful act. And we're saying that the harmful act in this case, the fact that the gator turned over on him certainly is relevant, is important. But the harmful cause, or the harmful result in this case, was that Hunter was under this gator for 4 to 6 hours, 30 miles north of Phillip, with no one to call on him. At the time they gave him this job to spray his weeds, they didn't warn him about the dangerous conditions on the land. He was operating this gator with one hand and spraying with the other. He tips over the gator. He doesn't have a cell phone or a two-way radio to call for help. He sits under the gator for several hours before his mother says at 6 o'clock that night, where's Hunter? And so she calls her brother in this family ranch situation, and where's Hunter? Well, I don't know. I sent him out spraying 6 hours ago. So they go out and find him trapped under this gator. So what is the proximate cause, the legal cause, of the harmful result? what is the harmful result? We're saying there's a question of fact that the court shouldn't have resolved as a matter of law in a summary judgment proceeding, that the harmful result was caused by tipping over the gator. It's our point that the harmful result was caused by the fact that they sent him out there on this job. He rolls the gator. He didn't have any way to communicate with anybody to get any help. If someone had been there, if Truett had stayed there to supervise him, he could have rolled the gator off him. There would have been no damages. Hunter Peterson was a senior in high school, getting ready for his high school senior year. He was a starting quarterback. He was a state-level wrestler. He ended up having multiple surgeries, $372,000 worth of medical bills, and he sustained a permanent injury to his leg, all of which could have been avoided if Hunter would have supervised him. He sent him out there to do this job, and he didn't provide him the means to call for help, and he wasn't there to supervise him.
So in Corzon, when we discussed the concurrent cause doctrine, we indicated that where two perils are involved, one's compensated, one is covered by an insurance policy, one's not. Now, hear your argument to acknowledge, yeah, that's where we're at. One's covered, and in our view, the common law negligence claims would be covered, of course. Then the peril with the gator would not be covered. So in those instances, we said, in describing this doctrine, if they're inextricably intertwined and they can't be separated, which may have been similar to what Justice Kern was asking, in those instances, if you can't define from those two causes predominant cause, then the coverage could be excluded. So that's how we've described it in the past. So is it so much a question of cause or even cause in fact, or is it just the fact that there may be difficulty in separating the two reasons, even in your view, why Hunter was tragically hurt?
Well, my response to that is to point to South Dakota law, which is in our jury instructions, which is based upon several Supreme Court cases. And it's jury instruction 20-10-10. A legal cause is a cause that produces some harmful result in a natural and probable sequence, and without the harmful result would not have occurred. A legal cause does not need to be the only cause of the harmful result. A legal cause may act in combination with other causes to produce a harmful result. And then jury instruction 20-1020 goes on to say that, you know, I think your point, Justice Salter, is, you know, liability can't be based upon speculation or remote probabilities. The defendant's conduct must have such an effect in producing the harmful result as to lead reasonable people to regard it as a cause of the plaintiff's harmful result. So what we're saying in this appeal is, Corzon kind of blinds us to the fact to say just because a motor vehicle is involved, the RV exclusion applies, there's no coverage. But coverage H is there to cover other farm activities. And this was clearly under the terms of the policy. It was a farm activity, it was on coverage territory, and the policy was in effect.
Is there a difference between the causation requirement that you just described for a fact finder and the causation that a judge examines when a judge is reading an insurance policy to determine, to interpret it, and to determine whether an exclusion applies or doesn't apply? Are those the same sorts of causation? Or
I think we're dealing with the age-old concepts of foreseeability, proximate cause, legal cause. That's why I think I was blinded by Corzon until I reread this and read Paul's graph. I went back to law school. I read Paul's graph, and Paul's graph is an old Supreme Court case, United States Supreme Court case, U.S., or it's a New York State case dealing with proximate cause, which may be Greek to the high school students here, but it's what you learned in law school. It's what we struggle with every day. It's what judges do every day. Judge Northrup made fact-finding when she discounted the non-gator-related concurrent causes. Now, Judge Barnett said in his ruling that was affirmed by this court in Corzon, no truck, no fire, no lawsuit. You know, for the benefit of the audience, you know, this was a course, that involved a fire that was started by a truck that's going down the road near Murdo. And they offered alternative reasons in order to get to the insurance company. And they said those reasons were failure to contain or suppress the fire upon discovery, negligently directing the fire department to meet at I-90, failure to properly and adequately and reasonably inspect the truck and its equipment, negligently deciding to haul hay on a day like yesterday, negligently allowing fire from the Corzon truck to property of others.
Those, you've got about 2 minutes.
Those are remote. I mean, I understand Corzon. Those are remote. That's speculative. Now, if this court were to adopt the concurrent cause theory, and we cited five cases throughout the United States, mostly in the Midwest, that have adopted such a doctrine, that basically says that where a motor vehicle is involved, along with other concurrent factors, the insurance company still has a duty to defend. If those concurrent factors could approach proximate cause, could approach the legal cause, it's referred to as legal cause. Now, in our case, the legal cause that caused this accident was the lack of supervision and the lack to provide a radio to Hunter as he sat trapped under this gator for 5 hours, crushing his leg.
Is there evidence in the record, or was there before the court on summary judgment, that would support a theory that had someone been there to lift the gator up sooner, he would not have suffered injury?
We didn't have time to get to the litigation or the discovery phase on that. There are medical records in the case, but the motion for, we filed the lawsuit, and then immediately there was a declaratory judgment action filed by the insurance company. And then within 3 weeks, there was a motion for summary judgment on the exclusions. So we didn't have really have time in the record or to develop a record with respect to what the consequences of the lack of supervision and the lack of communication device were. But to sum up, we're saying that reasonable people could differ in terms of the causation of this accident. And the standard that applies on a motion for summary judgment is that all facts should be viewed in favor of the non-moving party. The fact that we may not prevail is not, or surmise that we may not prevail, is not grounds to deny the motion for some, or to grant a summary judgment. We're asking for a trial on those concurrent causes.
Your time's up, Mr. McGill. Thank you. Ms. Fisher-Larson, you may proceed with your argument. You might just pull that mic down a bit so that people can hear you.
May it please the court, counsel. Your honors, the sole issue on appeal taken by Mr. Peterson in this matter is whether or not the concurrent cause doctrine applies in this situation. Mr. Peterson agrees that the gator in question was a recreational vehicle used for farming purposes and thereby excluded. However, as the court heard, Mr. Peterson is arguing that there is somehow an additional cause in addition to the gator in question that led to the accident that occurred that should bring this matter into coverage. The problem with that argument, however, your honors, is that no matter how you look at this case, that gator is inextricably intertwined with the injury that occurred in this situation.
Mr. McGill advances the argument that even getting to that stage implicates questions of causation that are better left to a fact finder than a judge. What do you think about that?
I would disagree with that situation or with that assertion. I think you look at the complaint itself in the underlying case, and the complaint itself says that the gator tipped over, landed on Peterson, trapping him for several hours. There is no way that you get a gator on top of somebody. There's no way that you get an injury from a gator on top of somebody without the use of the gator. It does not require any level of fact finding because the Mr. Peterson has provided that himself in his complaint. As stated in Corazon in this matter, the concurrent cause doctrine, for the concurrent cause doctrine to apply, Peterson is going to need to demonstrate at least one independent act of negligence that caused the injury, not an injury, the injury. We need to take a look at the allegations put forth by Mr. Peterson. Failure to train to use the gaiter. Failure to supervise him while using the gaiter. Failure to warn about using the gaiter on terrain. Failure to provide an emergency device to essentially get the gaiter off of him. All of those involve the gaiter. One, an emergency device did not cause the injury. It may go to damages, but it has nothing to do with causation. The other things all involve the gaiter. This case is even more clear than the Corazon case. In the Corazon case, at the very least, it was a bale that started on fire that was somewhat the cause of the fire in question, and it just happened to be a motor vehicle pulling that gaiter, or excuse me, that bale. Here, it is the gaiter itself causing the injury. Now, I think other case law that Mr. McGill has cited is somewhat instructive to show in a situation where the concurrent cause doctrine could apply. And I think the prime example of that is the Colell case in Iowa. What we have with the Colell case in Iowa is a gentleman was sawing down a tree branch. He saws 3/4 of the way through a tree branch, ties a rope to it, and uses a pickup to pull that tree branch down. That tree branch falls and falls on somebody, killing that person. The argument was that the concurrent cause doctrine should apply because the vehicle wasn't necessary to that injury. And the court found that. The court found that you could pull on a tree branch with a rope without a vehicle and cause that injury. And so they came up with a theoretical causation for the exact injury that occurred without the use of the vehicle. Here, there is no theoretical cause of an injury that gets a gaiter on top of somebody without the use of the gaiter. As such, we urge the court to affirm the circuit court's findings that the concurrent cause doctrine most certainly should not apply in this situation and affirm the underlying exclusion. That being stated, Your Honors, we did ask for a notice of review as to whether or not Mr. Peterson was an employee or not. And we feel that the circuit court did err in that regard.
Which we would not reach if we accept your initial argument.
Correct. Correct. If you accept our initial argument, there is no need to move on to the employee. But in the event, we would ask you to take a look at the definition of the employee under this. The definition of employee, it's very important that you read the policy definition. I mean, that's what the court is bound to. This is a contract case. You read the definitions in the policy. The various case law cited by Mr. McGill and Peterson in their matter dealt with situations where either the definition of employee was different or there was no definition of employee, period. So you went to that common law definition of what an employment agreement is, what, you know, to look for in terms of employment. Here, what we have is employee is defined as employee means any person providing a service to the insured. That is the starting point. Everything else in that definition is inclusive. It's expansive. The goal is to say including but not limited to instead of limiting that definition. So thereafter, it's any person providing a service to the insured, whether the employment agreement is express or implied, oral or written, lawful or unlawful, including relatives, aliens, minors, regardless of the duration of employment, and whether or not that person is compensated. Now, the circuit court found a question of fact as to whether there was an employment agreement in this situation. However, when looking at it, you need to look at the definition of what an employment agreement would constitute in this situation. It stands to reason that employee is a person providing a service to the insured, and so therefore an employment agreement would be anybody or an agreement to provide a service to the insured, which is what occurred in this situation. Now, I know in the dispute of material facts, Peterson brought up several allegations that he was Grandpa's helper, that there wasn't an explicit employment agreement by any means. Those are mere denials, which cannot be taken as a true dispute of material fact. When looking at a dispute of material facts, the person opposing it needs to put forth evidence showing that there is a true dispute. The evidence that they put forward is actually rather favorable to showing that there was employment in this situation. They agreed that the gator was used for farming at the time of the accident. They admitted he was farming and doing performing services for Burgess. That was admitted. The only dispute was whether or not an employment agreement was required. The spraying occurred on a field rented by Burgess and Cheryl. Truett, they admitted, was an employee and agent and a believed partner of BC Fitch Partnership. That makes Truett an insured under the policy. If you look at Section C of the policy as to who is an insured, employees as well as agents are considered insureds under the policy. Additionally, Burgess paid him, and Burgess issued a W-2 to Peterson. Hunter had previously worked for the Fitches. He usually performed work such as branding, moving bales, farming-related.
Well, could I interrupt for just a second, please? I'm sorry. On this issue of the compensation and the W-2, I mean, it seems like the W-2 kind of came along later and was unsolicited and may have occurred in the midst of some of the early stages of this claim. My question is, though some of that might be disputed in terms of compensation, how much it was, whatever, are those disputes material here if the definition contemplates an uncompensated employee?
That is absolutely correct, Mr. Justice.
It's incorrect?
That is correct. That is absolutely correct.
Well, it could be correct. I didn't know.
Exactly. No compensation is required. What I would say is that W-2 goes to clarity if we are concerned about an implied employment contract, given the fact that, I mean, it's everybody's seen a W-2. It lists employer name, employee name, et cetera.
Is the liability coverage portion of the policy in coverage H? And is the definition of an employee here, would you say more expansive, less expansive, about what you would expect for the common law? Does it really matter? What are your thoughts about that?
I would say it is by all means more expansive than the common law. What I would clarify, Mr. Justice, is that the definition of employee is not specific to coverage H. It's specific to the entire farm liability policy. The definitions are in Section F. The coverages are in Section A, I believe. But you are correct. It is very expansive. It is more inclusive in determining an employee than our common law definition, which I think gets to the most important point that was put forth in Mr. Peterson's disputed material facts. The most important point to this is he states that Truett called him to come help spray, and Peterson agreed to come help spray. Thereafter, he sprayed and he was injured as a result. That is an explicit agreement. That is an agreement to perform a service for the insured and getting injured while performing that service for the insured. If that is not an explicit agreement, it is most certainly implied, because when looking at an implied agreement, you look at the various acts and actions of the various parties involved. Now, it was somewhat alluded to in Peterson's brief that, well, it was Truett that asked him to come out, and it wasn't Burgess. Burgess is the named policyholder in this situation. That shouldn't count. Well, again, Truett is considered an insured. But furthermore, it's also important to take a look at that definition of employee. Employee means any person providing a service to the insured. It does not say at the insured's request. It says any person providing a service to the insured, and then goes into that expansive and all-inclusive, including all of the things.
So let me ask you this, under the policy language, let's say Hunter shows up for Thanksgiving dinner. After dinner, he picks up the dishes for Grandpa, puts them in the dishwasher, isn't asked to do it, isn't paid for it. Does that be the definition of an employee under the policy?
Theoretically, Your Honor, yes. However, that would make him a residence employee, which would be included under coverage in this situation. There are exclusions under the exclusion for employees for residence employees in this situation.
So let's say he does something outside. Let's say he turns the water on and waters the lawn for him. Is he an employee?
We're dealing with the lawn. I would say that falls under the residence employee situation.
Let's go out in the pasture then, and he opens up a gate for Grandpa when he drives through the pasture gate. Is he an employee?
I think that would highly depend on the situations in that. So
at some point, even under that very expansive definition, it becomes a question of fact, and you have to look at all the circumstances.
Correct. But in this situation, and I think, Mr. Chief Justice, you put that well, traditionally, as the circuit court erred on the side of caution, that finding of employment is traditionally a question of fact. However, under the Bergeson case, that very same case that says it's traditionally a question of fact, the very next sentence says, however, if this is clear, the court can find as a matter of law. Your Honors, we would contend that this is clear. I mean, I don't know how clear you get when somebody gets a W-2 for what he's doing. You've got Grandpa. I would ask you to look at the reported statements of Burgess Fitch that occurred a couple days after the accident, where he's saying, granted, he's not under oath, but he's reported, and there's a transcript of it in the record. You know, yeah, it's all work related. Yeah, he's just part-time help. We do this. He works for us in the summer, does this. Then he finds out that employees are excluded under the policy, and all of a sudden he turns into Grandpa's little helper. I think what we're running into, and what the arguments that they're attempting to make in this situation, is that Peterson is somehow without recourse if there is no policy coverage here. And that is not the case, Your Honors. He has every right to seek recourse and seek redress from his grandfather. The problem is, as much as his grandfather wants to help, he cannot have his insurance company pay for some insurance that he did not receive. If he had had a workers' compensation endorsement, we would have a different argument and there would be coverage, but he did not seek that workers' compensation endorsement, and therefore he is seeking to apply coverage to a policy that was never intended to apply to this situation. As such, we would ask for your affirming of the circuit court's findings under the concurrent cause doctrine matter, but we would additionally ask that should that not apply, you should find that Mr. Peterson is an insured, an employee under this policy, and find he is also excluded.
Does his status as a farm employee relate only to the Medicaid coverage?
Yes. Yes. Generally, so there are two main coverages that apply, and I appreciate that question. There are two main coverages that apply in this situation. There is the bodily injury coverage, and there is the $5,000 Medicaid coverage. The bodily injury coverage is, you know, what you generally seek under the insurance policy. That's coverage H. MedPay coverage is that of just $5,000 for medical payments. Farm employees are excluded under the medical payments coverage. All employees, save for there's a list of exceptions in the exclusions, are excluded under the bodily injury.
Is there coverage. A difference, counsel, between the definition of farm employee in your view and the definition of employee when we're looking at the medical payments coverage?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, the definition of farm employee is listed in the definitions. It is an employee whose duties are principally involving the act of farming.
But it, as applied to the facts in this case, is there any different outcome in implying that definition in your view for the medical payments coverage?
No, Your Honor. And that's simply because the appellants have admitted that he was doing farming at the time, and the prior discussions in his dispute of material facts, as well as Burgess Fitch's statements of his prior actions, all involve farming. There is no allegations that he was doing any type of dishes or anything like that for grandma and grandpa on Thanksgiving.
Do you believe that definition encompasses it? Because it refers to an employee. Does that in any way encompass the prior definition of employee?
Yes, it does. It's an employee whose principal duty. So it would be a person performing a service for the insured that relates to farming, essentially, if we wanted to combine the total definition. You'd have to read those in conjunction with one another.
You know, it's interesting, though, in the farm employee, and I don't know that this matters to your argument or to our analysis, but it's interesting because the definition of farm employee doesn't use that quoted version of employee, but the policy throughout it uses quotes when it references a defined term. And so, and again, I don't know if this matters or not. I wondered if maybe the definition of farm employee might not be narrower. And it seemed like maybe the bigger difference is that with a definition of employee, that specifically could be uncompensated, but I wasn't so sure if farm employee was that broad, because it doesn't seem to use the quoted employee. And I wonder if that was maybe a more traditional employment relationship.
I would disagree with that. I believe it was intended to encompass an employee under the definition.
It's interesting, though, that they don't use that quoted, they don't quote employee as they do other terms.
That is interesting.
You're getting close on your time, just to give you a heads up.
Ultimately, Your Honors, we'd ask you to affirm the Circuit Court's decision in this matter, and I will yield the rest of my time to questions if necessary.
Thank you. Mr. Miguel, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Yeah, following up on the discussion regarding farm employee and employee, I can't cite you book and verse as to the language where it is, but I believe in the definitions of farm employee, there's language that says the definition of farm employee excludes from the definition, quote, a neighborly exchange of assistance to which no insured is obligated to pay any money. And so I was confused in terms of whether that creates an ambiguity. We didn't argue ambiguity, but it sure makes it ambiguous. But what does that mean? Does that mean that if can Hunter be a neighbor? And that's why I was talking about the compensation. And that's where Mahan versus Mahan comes into play. And there is questions about, well, what are you talking about those Supreme Court cases precedent for? Because we're looking at an insurance contract. But as we read what an implied agreement for employment is, you run into Cord versus Reynolds, you run into Setlip, you run into Mahan. And Cord versus Reynolds involves a ranch hand who started working for a rancher. He gets promoted. He gets a place to live. He gets established hours. He gets a name, foreman. He gets hurt in an accident. Arguments made. He's not an employee, you know. And so in that particular case, it was ruled as a matter of summary judgment, as a matter of law, that it was clear that he clearly was an employee. And that's what I was trying to get at when I was saying that there is no agreement with respect to compensation. This case is completely distinguishable from Cord versus Reynolds. In the Setliff case, we have a doctor who came to work in Sioux Falls, worked for 9 months. The law firm drew up a contract, but he never signed the contract. So there is a dispute over his employment status. The Supreme Court rules that in that case, it was a matter of law that he clearly was an employee. Our case presents a much less clear situation. And that's what we're saying, that I think that Judge Northrup was correct to, as Tara said, err on the side of caution, to rule that as a matter of summary judgment law, she was not going to grant summary judgment. And the trial court should be left to get into all the facts and circumstances relating to the employment situation. Hunter is much more like a neighbor coming on to do this work. If they gave him a few bucks in the past, that may have been paid for his mileage. I mean, I think that would be the purpose of the trial, to get into exactly how often he came out and worked and what the understanding and agreement was. The W-2.
But if you were successful in maybe litigating that, and maybe you're right, Mr. McGill, maybe farm employee invokes a more traditional sense of what we think of as an employee. And there's the authorities outside of the insurance policy, as you point out, that could be used in that regard. But if that were right, would that only relate to the MedPay coverage, though? And how would that jump over to the definition of employee that's the bigger, broader, more expansive definition and the more significant, really, to the coverage question?
Well, it leads to an absurdity, because if you follow that language, that thinking, and say that, well, this expansive, non-compensated stranger walks upon the place is an employee. That's what this insurance policy says. The mailman is an employee. What was it that Tara said? She said, any person providing service to the insured. That would be anybody coming upon the place.
But that's what the policy says.
That's what the policy says.
Yeah, I think she's reading from the policy.
Right. Every person providing service to the insured, non-compensated, could be the mailman delivering mail. They're an employee. So if he gets run over by a gator, you know, good luck with that case. You know, we have the mailman got run over by a gator. I mean, because he's an employee, right? Any person providing services. So at some point, some non-absurdity has to be interjected into the notion of interpreting contracts. And I know this is not willy-nilly. I mean, this is sacred duty here to determine what this insurance contract means. That's what you are making rules for the state of South Dakota. And again, as I drove across South Dakota, there's these gators all over the place. And so this will apply.
Mr. Now, McGill, I want to go back to the concurrent cause. And Ms. Fisher-Larson talked about, you know, how inextricably combined. I think there's a notion that
if you were to adopt the concurrent cause, it would be a floodgate of litigation. But I think how you get away from that is, what is the remoteness in time? And even in the Corzan case, there's a reference made to the Schmidt opinion. And it basically says that how the other states have limited Corzan or the concurrent care cause doctrine is that, as the Schmidt court stated, this is quoted in the Corzan opinion, the district court may consider theoretical possibilities to explain how the accident could have occurred without a motor vehicle in determining whether to apply the divisible concurrent cause doctrine. But if those possibilities are too remote, the doctrine will not be applied. So in other words, Chief Justice Jensen is saying, what concurrent causes would meet that definition? And I'm saying there's a failure to advise, you know, warn him about the premises that led to him rolling over the gator in the first place. It is true the gator is the efficient cause of the incident, but the harmful result, as defined by our jury instructions, is the fact that he got hurt. I mean, and there it's the failure to provide equipment, proper equipment. That's the proximate cause of this injury. And as Justice Devaney said, we didn't have time to develop how a delay in response a last chance to save. A last chance to save is really what this involves. If Truett had been there watching him, he'd run over there and tip over that gator. And that 2,000, well, if he could lift 2,000 pounds, then it wouldn't have crushed his leg. We're saying that the failure to supervise, failure to provide equipment, communication equipment in a remote area of Hawken County, those are the non-remote concurrent causes for the harmful result in this case. I think that Nationwide focuses too much on, well, I've used the word concurrent cause doctrine, but really it's established South Dakota law in those jury instructions that I cited. We have a case involving a serial automobile case that I cited in my brief. It happened outside of Sioux Falls. It's a foggy night. There's a truck that goes and hits a bridge. Visibility is 50 miles. A vehicle stops, and then another vehicle comes and hits a bridge. The person that gets injured sues both people. The trial court rules those are separate injuries. Those are separate injuries. They're separate causation factors. This court reversed that on appeal and said, and it was done on a summary judgment. And on appeal, the Supreme Court said, no, the concurrent causes of this accident should be tried as one. You can't deal with this on a summary judgment. This needs to be dealt with in a trial. So we have to take a step back and look at the posture of this case. The posture of this case is at summary judgment. And so what we're asking for is the court to remand this down to the trial court to have a full hearing on the proximate cause issues. I know that's a long answer to your question, but that's how I think the fact, that's why it isn't entwined. To de-entwine it is what we're trying to do. And I think that's what a trial would do, to examine the causative, what is the most efficient cause of this accident? And that's what I think what this case is about. It's an opportunity for the court to expand the law. That's certainly not something that the insurance company would like to see, or the insurance industry. And it could lead to more litigation, but there won't be a floodgate of litigation because it cannot be remote. Those other factors cannot be remote. Any ruling adopting the concurrent cause doctrine in this case would be very limited and narrow to the situation where you have a failure to provide safety, and those non-vehicle factors would be part and parcel of any ruling. You know, failure to warn Hunter Peterson.
Your time is up, Mr. McKinney.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to thank counsel for your arguments today, and the court will be in recess for 10 minutes.